This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
California is home to 10.5 million immigrants, 22% of the foreign-born population nationwide. In 2023, 27% of California's population was foreign-born, which is the highest share of any state. And full disclosure, I was born and raised outside of the U.S., which makes me one of the 10.6 million. Immigrants face numerous challenges while living in these United States, including discrimination and numerous barriers when attempting to access care. This situation may be worsening again. Today, Dr. Raul Gutierrez will elucidate for us the current situation for immigrant children with special health care needs and how best we can be supportive. Dr. Gutierrez is a community pediatrician at San Francisco General Hospital, specializing in immigrant health and services. As an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, he co-founded and co-directs the Bridges Clinic, a multidisciplinary team dedicated to a holistic and community-supported approach to wellness for recently immigrated children and their families. He currently also chairs the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Immigrant Child and Family Health. Welcome, Dr. Gutierrez.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Dr. Takayama, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad to be here in this context talking about immigrant health. This is something that's very dear to my heart and something that I've devoted many years of my career on at this point. I don't have any disclosures, so we'll move on from there. And then today, we're going to talk a little bit about immigration as a key political and also social driver of health, describe some of the potential health impacts, and also think about how to mitigate some of the harm due to immigration policy within our health systems and our clinical settings. It's a lot to do in 30 minutes. I won't get to all of it, and I'm going to try to put this kind of lens on disabilities in general, not just developmental disabilities. And I know that I think I'm speaking mostly to people in California, but do, I think, take into consideration the importance of some of these things in different states that might not be as welcoming or who have fairly active anti-immigration policies that affect children and communities in general. So who is an immigrant child? And this is kind of a general definition. Immigrant children are defined as children who are foreign-born or children born in the United States who live with at least one caretaker who is foreign-born. So this is a much broader umbrella to talk about immigrant children, because we know that immigration policy not only affects the person that it's targeted for, but also has some collateral harm to those peoples who live in households where a loved one is maybe an immigrant themselves. And so I am talking about first generation children. I'm talking about second generation children. I'm also talking about children in mixed status families where they may have some other loved one, a grandparent, a great grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, who may also have a different status other than being a citizen of the United States. And as mentioned, 25% of all children, or 18 million in the US, live with at least one immigrant parent, a quarter in all of the country, and 5.1 million live with at least one undocumented parent. And when we talk about documentation status, there is all sorts of statuses that you can think about. I've put them in these kind of general buckets of a naturalized citizen, a permanent resident, a refugee or an asylee, someone who has what's kind of termed twilight status. So things like temporary protected status or humanitarian parole or DACA, and of course, folks who are undocumented are also in this bucket. So we can have all different sorts of mixes of people that we're talking about. Immigration status is in and of itself can also inform the way people move about their daily lives. California specifically has more immigrants than any other state. In 2023, 27% of California's population was foreign-born. The national average is 12%. And foreign-born residents represented at least one-third of the population in five counties: Santa Clara, San Mateo, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Alameda. Which means that half of California children have at least one immigrant parent or caretaker. That is a lot of children. That is a lot of people that we need to be thinking about as we talk about immigration policy and its effects. Again, I like to think about immigration as a social and a political driver or determinant of health. On the social side of things, immigration status significantly influences access to resources and opportunities. And as a political driver, it really shapes the experience and health outcomes of immigrant families. And so we can see that when there's anti-immigration policy that's put into place, that usually means that there is some enforcement of that immigration law that then changes the environment or changes behavior, so that downstream we have impacts on the access to health care services as well as health outcomes. I won't dive into all of those necessarily today, but certainly there are resources for you to think more about that, and I'll share those at the end. And the other one thing I wanted to say is that I also think about immigration status as influencing or cutting across all other social drivers of health. And from a socio-ecological model, right, we can see that at the personal level or individual level, at the community level, and so on and so forth. And again, these slides will all be shared with you. So you can dive into these things a little bit deeper if you'd like. But really thinking about how immigration layers on all the other social and political drivers of health that sometimes exacerbates. Hopefully we think it'd improve some of those things, but many times it does exacerbate some of those social needs. And so now I want to talk a little bit about universal rights for immigrant children. And the fact is that there aren't many. I feel that all children, regardless of immigration status, should be entitled to certain fundamental rights, not only under US law, but just through international conventions, and that these should ensure their safety, their well-being, and their development. Unfortunately for healthcare, that is not the case here in this country, and access to healthcare will vary from state to state, with some exceptions, particularly emergency medical care that should be available to all under the EMTALA laws. And some states provide different types of programming that might give some type of full coverage or limited coverage. Education, however, education is protected regardless of immigration status based on Pillar versus Doe in 1982. And schools cannot deny enrollment based on immigration status or require documentation that would reveal status. Now, this is being challenged in some states in the country at the moment. But for now, this Supreme Court ruling holds. And we'll see if that will be challenged in the future as these state laws start to be enacted. That would then be challenged and potentially go to the Supreme Court. And so we see this, and this is just one example, right? This is a chart of federally means-tested programs. And depending on your status, so if you're a lawful permanent resident versus a refugee and asylee, whether you're lawfully present or you're undocumented, access to things like ACA, SNAP, Medicaid, CHIP, TANF, SSI varies. And in some instances varies drastically. And you can see that some folks are eligible, some are not eligible. And then there's this kind of in-between where there could be state options for folks, or there might be 5-year waiting periods that people have to adhere to. And so as you can see, this can get very complex in terms of understanding what is available to a family, to a patient, and what you can offer to help kind of mitigate any types of harms or to try to help with medical care. This is a chart showing healthcare coverage for children across the state. Those in the dark blue are medical coverage for children regardless of immigration status, and those in the light offers Medicaid or CHIP for lawfully residing children regardless of date of entry. And then all the other ones have restrictions or no eligibility. And so, you know, that dark blue is growing from year to year. We might have a bit of a pause going on, hopefully no rollbacks from any of federal policy, because we know that Medicaid is under attack at the moment. And so we'll see where this goes. And so healthcare coverage in California specifically, we have Medi-Cal, California's Medicaid program, that is available to everyone at this point, regardless of immigration status, so long as you are eligible. There are some, some barriers in terms of registration and renewal that can be challenging, particularly for immigrant families. There's also California Children's Services, which I'm sure you all know about, providing additional support for eligible children, regardless of immigration status. And then I just wanted to put here that there is, for mixed status families, there is things like supplemental security income and other means tested programs that might be available for eligible children. There's a QR code that you can use, and I'll have a bunch of QR codes that are available to you. But this one takes you to major benefit programs available to immigrants in California, and it goes through each program and eligibility. And if you want to take a deeper dive around that, you can. And so again, I want to point out that all children with disabilities have the right to learn. And for children with special healthcare needs, immigration status can sometimes compound the different barriers to care, creating layered vulnerabilities that require specialized approaches from healthcare providers, educators, social service professionals, and that we hope that our families are aware of to be able to help them. And this is where we get into a kind of our alphabet soup here. So thinking about, and I put this here only to point out that in some instances, school systems are going to be the foundation for the type of care that children are getting. And in some states, this might be the only place that they're getting consistent care and support for the disabilities that they might be living with. And so I want to point out things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and of course the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which gets you things like IEPs. Individuals with Disabilities Education Act ensures students with disabilities receive free appropriate public education. It covers all students with one of 13 classifying disabilities that impact learning regardless of immigration status, and provides special education services like one-to-one teaching, speech therapy, OT, PT, and things like that. Section 504 prohibits discrimination based on disability by any program receiving federal financial assistance. All people with disabilities that impairs one or more major life activities can get 504 plans, again, regardless of immigration status. And it provides reasonable accommodations, including medical support, testing modifications, physical access, and educational plans as well. And then the American with Disabilities Act is a broader disability law covering employment, government, public services, transportation, and so forth. Again, all people with disabilities with that impair major life activities, regardless of immigration status, and protection for anti-discrimination measures and reasonable modifications for equal access to service and programs. And so again, these collection of things, particularly for children in environments where they don't have access because of immigration status, are really, really important and can be really at the foundation of the services and support that they receive. The other thing that I wanted to point out here is for English language learners, is one that, again, all children have the right to attend school regardless of their immigration status and language being spoken. Parents do have the right to have all school communication, evaluations, and IEPs translated into their native languages. And parents have the right to have an interpreter present at all school meetings, especially in IEP meetings. If this is not happening for one of your patients or the people that you support, it is certainly something that should be brought up and brought to the school's attention. I also want to talk about English language learners and disabilities. One, to make sure that we are evaluating thoroughly. Don't confuse language differences with a disability. Distinguish between language acquisition and learning disabilities. And don't let language differences mask a disability. This happens very often, even with the science supporting that speaking two languages or learning English does not cause disabilities or delays in development. This comes up a lot. It's really upon us to be able to push back and say, language acquisition in any language is not the driver of any type of disability that you might be seeing. I also want to point out the Family Medical Leave Act. This is a job protected unpaid leave for qualified medical and family reasons. Those reasons are several and can include family illness. It provides job security up to 12 weeks leave and with continued benefits. And so immigrants are eligible for paid leave, paid family leave and state disability insurance benefits if you pay into the state disability insurance program and meet all other eligibility criteria. So it could be imperative to make sure that families are connected to the right legal services or support services to really explore whether these different programs can be available to them. All right, I'm going to jump into some potential threats here. And these are things that we've been hearing with the current administration over the past month or so. One is birthright citizenship. There have been challenges to birthright citizenship that could lead to create legal uncertainty for children and immigrants. One, we know that this is not immediately going to go into effect. We know that it's protected by the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and we know that attorney generals from 22 states sued, including the cities of San Francisco and Washington, D.C., on the merits that this, or on the basis that this is unconstitutional. This has not gone into effect. We don't expect it to go into effect. That being said, there are certainly families who are concerned about what might be happening to their children who are born here in the United States. The other one is mass deportation, which by and far is really just causing a lot of confusion and fear. And mass deportation policies tend to create anxiety, families fearing separation and instability. And we know that communities, when these types of policies are put into place, that communities are less safe. People are afraid to drive to access public services, are afraid to use parks and exercise outside, are afraid to, might miss medical appointments and are afraid to get involved in their communities. We also know that there's potential immigration enforcement in clinical settings. This was a policy that was revoked, a 2011 policy that restricted ICE enforcement in sensitive locations was revoked. Those sensitive locations include hospitals and other clinical settings. And we know that this type of activity may deter families from seeking essential services, not only in school that we just talked about, all the services they might be getting there, but also their appointments and medical support systems. And of course, all these things really leads more than anything into a chilling effect. It creates anxiety among immigrant families and access to resources are at risk. And that could look like missed appointments, that could look like disenrollment from Medi-Cal or Medicaid systems or other means-tested support systems, and missing services, either directly from medical providers or from school-based services as well. And we already know that some of these disparities already exist. In California, looking at uninsured rates for all Californians, 0 to 64, undocumented residents have an uninsured rate of 27%. Uninsured rates among most children are fairly low. However, we do see disparities based on immigration status as well, with the highest being non-citizen children. And we also have learned from the past. In 2019, 25% of low-income adults in California reported avoiding public programs out of fear of participating would negatively impact their status. The share of children receiving things like TANF and SNAP and Medicaid fell about twice as fast among U.S. citizens, U.S. citizen children with non-citizen household members, as did those among children with only U.S. citizens in their household. And national participation in programs like SNAP among children in mixed status households dropped about 22.5%, 5 times that of US children in citizen-only households. We've also seen some studies where they looked at adherence to healthcare utilization and in the setting of anti-immigration policy. And we saw that immigrant mothers showed a decreased well-child check adherence, missed opportunities for vaccinations and healthcare screenings, and fewer opportunities for family supports and education are available when they miss these appointments. Even here in San Francisco, we looked at how folks were using emergency departments. And 70% of undocumented Latinos and 51% of legal Latino residents reported that anti-immigration rhetoric back in 2016 made them feel unsafe living in the United States. And many of them thought that some of the changes had already taken place, even though they weren't actually initiated. Undocumented Latinos were also more likely to report that these statements made them afraid to come to the ED. Of that group, 55% stated it caused them to delay coming to the emergency department. Another threat is the defunding of Medicaid. There are potential cuts to Medicaid funding that could be severely impact access to care for immigrant children and families. I want to put an advocacy opportunity here as well. If you go to this QR code, that will take you to the California Medical Association's statement on the protecting access to care and opposing Medicaid cuts. If you'd like, you can go down to that to the bottom of that page and go ahead and write a letter to your legislators to be able to express to them what your feelings are on Medicaid defunding. The other thing that I wanted to bring about is this court case, Texas versus Becerra. This is a lawsuit that was initiated by 17 states suing the federal government over Section 504 rules, claiming that Section 504 is unconstitutional and demanding that they want to stop enforcement of updated rules and declare Section 504 illegal. So this is not only a potential harm to immigrant children, but really all children who rely on these on 504 plans and being able to get that support in the schools. And so what can we do as healthcare workers supporting children with disabilities? And with all of this information, it can certainly feel overwhelming. Like, what can we do? There's no movement here. How can we even move, shift the needle? And I want to say that it is possible for us to be in this more virtuous cycle that you see here, where there is a sense of social cohesion, a sense of belonging, and a sense of inclusion. And we do have some power and ability to be able to influence at least the spaces that we have some power or some influence on, those spaces around us. And some of the best things that we can do is to prepare, to protect, and to inform. And so I'm going to go through some of those potential strategies for you. So, one, creating welcoming spaces. You have the potential to be able to influence what your clinical space looks like. So ensure that your clinical space feels safe, that it has inclusive signage, that we're training staff to be culturally sensitive and practice cultural humility, and to be able to continue to build trust with your families. There's also this notion of sanctuary doctoring. So being able to have dialogue and talk to families about some of these concerns that they might have. Here are some potential strategies on how to open up that conversation. And this toolkit in particular goes through many other things that you potentially can do in your clinic to kind of help create that safe and welcoming space. We can also offer telehealth visits for those folks who might be missing appointments or not wanting to travel to get to you. So think about that. Do a quality improvement initiative and look for families who have been missing appointments and try to reach out to them and see if there are other ways that we can provide these supports and these services. And also thinking about language justice, or this idea that everyone should be able to communicate, understand, and be understood in the language they prefer. Let's not take those shortcuts. Let's try to institute best practices for the clinical settings that we're in. The Attorney General in California put out guidance for promoting safe and secure healthcare access for all. A lot of this is about knowing your rights as a clinician to be able to support families and also informing your patients about what their rights are and really thinking about confidentiality and protecting patients' information and making sure they're not more vulnerable than they need to be already in clinical settings. You can go here to read more about some of those policies and potentially share with your administrators to see what kind of procedures and workflows they have in place to be able to protect families from immigration enforcement in those spaces. Can also talk about family preparedness plans. This can reduce a lot of anxiety for families in terms of what's going to happen if anybody in their family is deported, particularly their primary caretaker for children with disabilities. These family preparedness plans really goes through a checkbox of documents that should be available, medications, contact information for medical providers, as well as affidavits to be able to assign another trusted adult to be able to make medical decisions for them in the case that a parent is deported or is not able to care for this person because of immigration enforcement. So I have that there for you. You can cross train your social workers or your case managers to be able to walk families through these types of preparedness plans. Support letters. Letters that can document the impact of deportation on a child's health can be particularly helpful. And that can be particularly helpful for families who are trying to do a cancellation of removal. These are parents or guardians who might have an order for deportation, but their lawyers are really working to cancel that removal. And having some evidence of medical hardship of the child that they're taking care of can be particularly helpful. Please make sure to speak with a lawyer if you were ever asked to write some type of letter like this. It could be really helpful in making sure that you write the most effective letter possible. There are also some tools, again, the QR code here that you can go to that guides you through some potential templates. And share those templates with each other. Have them ready to go. Put them in your EHR so that you can fill them in a little easier and take some burden and time off of having to write them. And I really encourage our subspecialists to think about this and how they might be able to be helpful in writing these types of letters. And then finally, I just wanted to offer you another place. This is a webpage called Everyone Belongs Here, put together by a bunch of healthcare workers put up-to-date information. It's really a clearinghouse of information that could be helpful to healthcare professionals on how to best support immigrant families in their clinical setting. And so please feel free to go there, dive into any of those things. There's a lot of tools that can be helpful to you and a lot of information, particularly if this is something new to you. All right. And I think I'm going to end there so that we have time for questions. That's my email address if you need it. And I'm going to stop share.
Raul, thank you very much for providing such a comprehensive summary on what immigrant children and families are experiencing and also ways that we might be able to help. And so I guess I have one sort of a personal question that I was thinking about, which is, for example, if we notice missed appointments and we think, we should find out why it was missed, of course, but are there like best ways or better ways to reach out? Our tendency is to pick up the phone and call, but I know that sometimes when people get telephone calls from a sort of an organization that they might be afraid that there's something going on, but and then should we leave voicemail? Is that a good way?
I think that's a great question, and I think there are different ways to do this, understanding the different barriers. We've had a big push in trying to get as many families as we can onto like things like MyChart to be able to communicate with their healthcare professionals. I think in instances where that is available, that could potentially be a way to communicate with folks. I think we do have to acknowledge the technical divide, particularly with immigrant families, and not be able to necessarily being able to access those technologies. But sometimes snail mail is just as great, and you can do that. And I'm a big fan of transparency, and I know there might be, you know, potential pushback from administrators, but it's a good to have at least the conversation and say like, hey, we have a high percentage of potential children in immigrant families. And sometimes you can use language as a proxy to really kind of understand your population a little bit better. And, you know, and say, it looks like we have an increase of no-shows. And that could be for many reasons. But, you know, I think there is benefit, again, in being transparent and honest and just being saying, and just saying, hey, you know, our practice acknowledges that, you know, we have children in immigrant families. And with the current amount of immigration policies that are out there, this could be anxiety provoking for you to make your appointment. If this is true for you, and you can put a bunch of other things in there, right? But if this is true for you, please feel free to reach out to you and see if we can find other alternatives to make sure that we continue to support you in taking care of your child, right? You know, vet it through all the people you need to vet it through, but at least have the conversation and see what you can do to reach out to these families to make sure that they're still getting to you, to support them and to equip them with the information that they need to know that you can stay on Medi-Cal. Let's see if we can connect you with someone to help you renew that if that didn't come to you. There are other ways that we can talk to you and see you and let us help you navigate those systems.
So be flexible, try different multimodal methods. Thank you so much for those tips. Clarissa, do you have a...
Yes, from the Q&A, could you speak to the importance of culturally affirming and bilingual physicians? And do you think San Francisco is doing better in healthcare provider diversity than other cities?
That's such a great question. You know, here's the reality. You know, when we talk, at least talking about physicians, you know, there's only 6% of physicians who identify as Latine. Maybe a little bit higher for those who identify as Black, and they're, you know, we have a lot of work to do across the board. Is San Francisco in general doing a better job than anybody else? I don't know that that's necessarily true. I don't have the data to back that up. I think that you will find that it might be better in urban centers. I think the numbers probably are much worse in rural areas. We have a lot of work to do on this front to be able to provide not only linguistically concording care, but also culturally concording care. I think that there are places who try to do this very well, who are very targeted to certain populations, for example, Asian Health Center in Oakland or La Clínica de la Raza. Are some things that are some organizations that come to mind. I think that there are academic centers who are really trying as much as possible to tailor and provide culturally concordant opportunities for families. And I think that's a growing movement. But, you know, there's a lot that I can talk about in terms of what the root cause of this lack of representation is, but that's a whole nother talk. And I think we still have a lot of work to do there.
Thank you.
And a big shout out to our foreign medical graduates who I think do a lot of this work. It really lies on their shoulders in many areas. And so big shout out to those folks.
So my take home is collaborate with others. Don't try to do it by yourself. And I see that the regional center services are not dependent on immigration status. That's in the chat. So
that's wonderful. Yes, thank you so much for pointing that out.
And is it okay if we reach out to Bridges Clinic? We do a site visit?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, feel free. Email me, and I'm happy to have you.
So I'm just going to read a comment also in the chat. As a first generation of everything, I'm so grateful for your work. As I am reliving immigration trauma from childhood that I went through with my own dad, I wish things were different 40 years later. And I think the sharing can also be sort of self-protective for all of us who are in this together.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of you are on the front lines of all of this that is happening. And you will be collecting stories about how all of this is impacting your families, you know, particularly for kids with disabilities. I mean, we talk about, you know, people who are marginalized, but then there's margins on the margins, right? As we talk about intersectionality. And so hold on to those stories. And if there's a way to respectfully use those stories to be able to advocate, you know, be on the lookout to be able to share those stories, whether it's in an op-ed, whether it's, you know, writing a congressperson, whether it's going to a rally, whether it's trying to change policy within your healthcare system. It's important. And these folks need their voices to be listened to. And we can be one way to be able to lift those voices.
Thank you so much. There's so much uncertainty about what might happen, but if ICE comes to your office, and you're nervous and you can't think and you don't have your resources, what can you boil it down to maybe one or two or maybe three? What do you do?
So what I'll say is, one, if this is a concern for you, please talk to your administrators, talk to your clinics, health services, hospital leadership, that these concerns are real, and that you are feeling them and that your staff is feeling them, and that you really need to do some training, and to have some policies and procedures in place. Please go to Everyone Belongs Here. There are lots of tips there in terms of how you can do that and to get you started, and to be able to share that with your administrators to be able to do that. Three, know your rights. Red cards. Red cards are very popular right now. Have those available. Have those available for yourself. Have those available for your families. Have them available in different languages. You can go to ILRC, Immigration Law Resource Center, and you can download PDF files and you can kind of cut them out and make them yourself. They're overburdened with orders, and so they can't get them all out there. But you can also just print them out and cut them and have them available for your families as well. Please read the document from our California Attorney General about things that you can do, and to be able to provide some guidance. And the gist is, one, make sure you know your rights. You don't have to talk to an immigration enforcement officer if you don't want to. And you should not get in their way either. That can be particularly dangerous for you. Please don't get in their way, but it doesn't mean you have to communicate with them. Remember that we do have privacy protection laws such as HIPAA and things like that. The appropriate subpoenas have to be in place. And again, this is where the training comes in and having a point person that you can go to be able to verify those things and provide access if they have the right things that they need to get that access. Otherwise, all your other PHI protections are in place, and those do stand. I wish we could do a whole nother talk on just this, but really just go to that resource, Everyone Belongs Here, and you'll see that'll be a great springboard into knowing more about this and how to strengthen protections in your clinical setting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much, Raul, for the presentation and all the work that you do.
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate being here. And again, a wonderful afternoon and weekend to all of you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.